They cannot do anything useful. Unless one can find a person transcendental to the four basic defects, one should not accept advice and become a victim of the material condition. The next process is to take the advice and instructions of Sri Krishna or his bona fide representative. In this way, one can be happy in this life
and the next.
Countries are different countries are exploiting, trying to exploit each other, and we are literally exploiting their resources. Like in Australia, it's about mining. The economy is built on mining. So we are literally exploiting, taking resources out of the earth to use for sense gratification. And when someone says, "I love you," there's, in the material world, there's no love. It is only calm, lust. So Krishna talks about calm in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And even Arjuna says, what is this enemy that covers us? And Krishna says this enemy is calm. It is lust, which everyone is blinded by it. And it resides in the body in various locations. So this material world is a place of lust. So when someone says, "I love you," what they're really saying is, "I want to exploit you." And you know, maybe we also said, "I love you," right? We to our beloved in the past. But that love is based on what can you do for me? Otherwise, there is dissent. So man, there's so many songs written on this love. You turn on the radio, you know, 101.1 FM or The Fox, whatever. There's so many songs on love. And these songs have been made since time immemorial. There have been songs made on love. But if you strip it, this is saying, "I want to lust you," or "I'm lusting over you," or "I want to exploit you." And then sooner or later, because we all are so tiny living entities, we are so tiny and we are part and parcel of Krishna, it is only Krishna who can truly fulfill our desires. And Krishna is Rishikesh, who is the master of the senses. And Krishna has the ability to fulfill all of his desires and all of everyone else's desires. Krishna can do that because that's what makes him God. So Krishna has unlimited potencies, and through those potencies, Krishna can fulfill all of his desires, and Krishna has unlimited desires. So I've heard my spiritual master say various times that we can only have limited desires. If we boil down all our desires, they come to maybe 7, 8, 9, or 10. We cannot have unlimited desires like Krishna has. So, but even with those desires, we are struggling to fulfill them, and we build various alliances and relationships with people in order to try to fulfill our desires. By trying to exploit them. And the relationship of a man and a woman is basically based on what can you do for me. That's how we approach each other. This is the alliance of marriage, or these days it's called a partnership. Like a business partnership. And in a business partnership, the terms are defined. You have to bring this to the table, I will bring this to the table, and then we'll try to make it work. And when the terms are not met, the partnership is ended. So there isn't an entity type of partnership. There's individuals, partnerships, trusts, right? So there's partnerships. So in partnerships, man and woman come together, and man has certain conceptions of enjoyment, and the woman has certain conceptions. So they try to come together to enjoy it. But because if it is devoid of any Krishna consciousness, what they're really trying to do is they're trying to exploit each other. So in the process, they get frustrated. So that's what happens when they try to exploit nature. When the tiny living entity tries to exploit the material energy, our attempts at exploitation become frustrated. And so whether it is man and woman coming together, or it is doing various alliances, different partnerships with people, in due course of time we get frustrated. Because the other person cannot fulfill us, because they are so tiny. They do not have the capacity to fulfill us. It's only Krishna, who is our Lord and Master, can fulfill our desires. And Krishna only fulfills our spiritual desires. Our material desires, Krishna has unwillingly agreed to put us in the material world to let us fulfill our desires. Because we have a stubborn nature, our stubborn desire is to be independent of Krishna, and then Krishna has put us in the material world. So where we can try to be the master and try to be happy, independent of Krishna. So Krishna has unwillingly put us here in order to frustrate us so that we can turn back to Him. That's why Krishna has put us in this material world. So we can try to be, we can try to play God. Everyone in this world is trying to be the master. And that's why Prabhupada uses the term lording it over nature again and again in the material world. Because everyone is trying to control us. So to be God means to be the supreme controller. But if you can't control, then you can't be the enjoyer. So people are trying to control so they can have a level of enjoyment. And that's why positions of controllership or directorship are very attractive in the material world. Everyone wants to be a director. A CEO or a boss. Or even if you're not a boss, we are trying to boss others. Even if you don't have the title of a manager. But everyone is trying to be a chief and trying to boss others around. Because in that way we can feel a sense of enjoyment. But the material world is meant to frustrate us so we can turn back to Krishna. That's the purpose of Maya Devi. So the material energy, which is matter, which is also Krishna's energy. And Krishna says, I have two types of energies. I have the Yoga Maya and the Mahamaya. So the Yoga Maya is Krishna's internal energy and gives us opportunities to serve Krishna. So when we turn towards Krishna, then the Yoga Maya gives us various facilities to serve Krishna. If we have that desire, if we have a desire to serve Krishna, it gets fulfilled. Krishna fulfills our desires to serve Him. But if we have material desires, then we hand it over to Mahamaya. Then Mahamaya takes care of us. By maybe giving us sometimes some success, and we get carried over by the success, and then we get a big slap. And again we get frustrated. And that's how the material world is. It's by nature, by design, it is there to frustrate us. And we are trying to overcome that design. We are so tiny. Out of stubbornness, we are trying to overcome the design of material nature, which is there to frustrate us. And as we turn to Krishna, we Krishna tries to fulfill our desires, but still the material energy is there to test us to see if we are sincere or not. So the other job of the illusory energy is to test our sincerity. Like Haridas Thakur, this is now Acharya. He was tested in the dead of the night when a beautiful prostitute came and offered her services to him. So ordinarily anyone would fall down. But Haridas Thakur was so fixed in chanting holy names, the Lord, that the that Maya Devi herself appeared as a prostitute, she was transformed. So in this way, Maya is there to test us. When we turn towards Krishna, the demigod is happy, we return to Krishna, and we get various facilities, but at the same time, we are tested thoroughly by various temptations are put in front of us to test our sincerity in going back to Godhead. And so sometimes we might fall down, but then we have to get up and continue towards our march towards back to Godhead. So we are always tempted by the illusion energy. But if we overcome these temptations, then we are coming closer and closer to Krishna. So those temptations are there to make us stronger in our as a devotee. So we might be tempted with money or position or by various opportunities to enjoy different ways of control. But if they're not done keeping Krishna's service in mind, then they will fall victim to the illusory energy. But if we keep Krishna in the center, then we come out stronger. You know, there's a saying, failure is a pillar of success. So these temptations are there to make us stronger. But if we put Krishna in the center of our dealings, then these cheating propensities go away. So, Vipradusa is the propensity of cheating, as I mentioned, is there because of the tendency to enjoy, exploit. Prabhupada also talks about it. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the first canto, 14th chapter, text number 4, in the Bhagavad, he says, a conditioned living being is endowed with the four principles of malpractice, namely errors, insanity, inability, and cheating. These are signs of imperfection. And out of the four, the propensity to cheat others is most prominent. And this cheating practice is there in the conditioned souls because the conditioned souls are primarily in the material world, imbued with an unnatural desire to guard it over the material world. So this is the root cause. And so we all have this propensity. And of course there has to be oversight. So we just can't be left to our own ends, even though we're devotees. So there needs to be a level of governance and oversight in order to avoid this propensity to cheat. Otherwise it can manifest at any moment even amongst us as spiritual practitioners. Just because we put on a yogi kurta doesn't mean we don't have a propensity. We all have it. So we have to try to be pure, but at the same time there has to be a level of oversight to curb that tendency. And ultimately this, you know, propensity is there because everything emanates from Krishna. Right? So Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, among cheats I am Gandhan. Right, so Krishna also cheats sometimes, and Krishna is the supreme truth, param satyam dhimahi. Krishna is the absolute truth, and whatever Krishna does is perfect. And Krishna's cheating is transcendental, whereas our cheating is not transcendental. It is entangling. So you know this famous pastime of Krishna telling Yudhishthira to lie to Dronacharya, to cheat Dronacharya. So Dronacharya is, you know, he was the teacher, Acharya, of Arjuna, the Pandavas. And so Dronacharya was on the side of the Kauravas. So and Dronacharya is a great, noble person. Somehow he came on the side of the Kauravas, the financial consideration, another reason. And then He was a great threat to the Pandavas, and he got so carried away by the propensity to fight. And so generally in Vedic warfare, or in the days of yore, as Devan Swami was mentioned 1 or 2 weeks ago, that there were certain codes of conduct when warfare would take place. You know, once the sun has set, you do not fight. And you only fight with someone who is your equal and who has a similar weapon system as you have. This is Vedic warfare. And it is done outside the kingdom. It is done in an isolated, deserted area. Like Maharaj was mentioning about giving the example of Kurukshetra. So Kurukshetra is a battle place, and it was far away from the city where people were residing. It was just maybe out in the bush. And if you want to do a battle, go in the bush, in the desert, and then fight over there. But modern warfare is the exact opposite. In fact, they use the night time to carry out their bombing campaign. So you can catch the opposing party by surprise. They use the element of surprise to bomb them. And modern warfare is all about gaining military superiority over your opponent by having very powerful weapons that the other, the army, that your opposing party doesn't have, it, right? So if you have maybe superior fighter jets than your opposition, or you have nuclear weapons. But in Vedic warfare, if you're fighting with a bow and arrow, then your opposition should also have that. And they should be skilled in fighting with a bow and arrow. Then you fight them. So if you have higher weapons than them and then they don't have, then you fight with someone else. That's how the war was, the battle was carried out. So you can see how today's warfare is the exact opposite. And it's carried out, the warfare is carried out in the midst of the citizens. Like looking in the Israel and Palestine conflict at the moment, it is taking place right in the midst of citizens. You know, Hamas is firing rockets indiscriminately in Israel at the citizens, and then they are firing back too. And even worse, sometimes the enemy is hiding in a hospital or somewhere else, so then they have to bomb that place. So this is Kali Yuga fighting. But before it wasn't like that. They would go in a deserted location and they would fight equally, and at sunset the fighting would stop. So the warriors have time to recuperate, patch their wounds, have a drink, eat something, rest. Then next day again, there's fighting. So Dronacharya, in the battle of in Mahabharata, in the battle of Kurukshetra, so he was made, you know, Dronacharya was made the commander-in-chief. So then Bhishma was lying in the bed of arrows. So he was the commander-in-chief. And he fought, he became infuriated, and he broke many of these military codes. So he was fighting people who were inferior to him, and he had lower grade weapons, and he was killing them indiscriminately. And even at sunset, Dronacharya, he kept fighting. So then he smelled the stench of the wounds from the soldiers and the smell of blood. It inflamed his passion to fight. And he kept fighting throughout the night. And so this had to be stopped. And then But Dronacharya, he knew no one can defeat him. So the only way to defeat him was to say that his son has been killed. That was the only way to sap his enthusiasm to fight. But his son Ashwatthama had a benediction that, you know, he can't be, you know, killed. He had a benediction by Lord Shiva. So then Krishna told Yudhishthira, you go and tell Dronacharya that your son Ashwatthama has died. Because if anyone else says, Dronacharya won't believe him. Because Ashwatthama has this benediction that he can't be killed. He has this benediction by Lord Shiva. So Yudhishthira is Dharmaraj. You know, Yudhishthira has never said a lie in his whole life. He has never carried out any immoral act or even thought of it. So if he says Ashwatthama has died, then it will be believed. And Yudhishthira, you know, when he was treated by Shukuni, so he even surrendered Draupadi, he surrendered his brothers, he surrendered his kingdom, and then he even accepted going into exile for such a long time. So then even if Yudhishthira says, then it carries weight. So Krishna told Yudhishthira, you go and cheat Dronacharya by lying to him. But Yudhishthira was very hesitant. So because Yudhishthira had never lied his whole life, he had gained so much power that his chariot would never touch the ground. It would always be gravitating. But after this incident, his chariot came down. And the acharya explained that's because he hesitated to lie, not because, you know, he said that, because he hesitated to lie. So Yudhishthira was really hesitant to go to Drona and say Ashwatthama is dead, because he knew this is lying. So he was really hesitating. So as a compromise, Krishna said, okay, there is an elephant called Ashwatthama, Bhima, you go and kill him. And that elephant was on their side. It was one of the Pandavas' elephants. So the elephant was killed by Bhima. And then he said, okay, now he should go and say, Ashwatthama, the elephant is dead. So he hesitated, but he went there. He went to, before that, even some people told Dronacharya that Ashwatthama is dead, but he didn't believe him. He said, I only believe when Yudhishthira says. And I think that Bhima told him that Ashwatthama is dead, but Drona didn't believe him. So then Yudhishthira went and he said, Ashwatthama, the elephant, is dead. And as he said the elephant, Krishna blew the conch. So, Drona, he only heard that Ashwatthama is dead. So Krishna, he tricked Dronacharya. We see even the Supreme God sometimes engages like this. But you know, Krishna is beyond reproach. Krishna is the absolute truth. So his activities are transcendental. And then when Dronacharya heard that, he loses his vitality, he loses his mojo, enthusiasm to fight. And then, as you know, Vishwadyumna, he killed Dronacharya. So Dronacharya, he decided meditation, he resigned from his commander-in-chief force, he sat in meditation and Vishwadyumna came around. Vishwadyumna chopped his head off, right? So in this way, Dronacharya was killed. Yeah, Krishna did that. There's various other examples also of Krishna cheating. But Krishna can cheat. Krishna can do these activities. And we also know Dronacharya was not right. So, there's an example of Sanatana Goswami. I gave this last time. I gave class 2 times ago. And Sanatana Goswami was imprisoned. He bribed the jailkeeper with some gold and he said, I'm going to Makkah. You let me out. I want to go to Makkah, that's why he let me out of jail. But he went to see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So he cheated the jailkeeper. So ordinarily in our transaction, we have to be, at least if we go, if we go, if we have to be, I think, you know, act in gentleman ways and not shame each other, because say things that you don't mean to say that, or, you know, comes out another way. In the short term, we might get what we want, but in the long term, it could destroy the trust and damage our relationships. Also, like, you know, in Bhagavad Gita, the Vaishyas, by occupation, they have to cheat, they have to lie. If they don't lie, then they cannot be a Vaishya. Like, they say, with you, I'm making no money. But, you know, they have a margin. If there's no margin, why will they be in business? So, sometimes, you know, it is in their occupational duty to engage in that way. So those are some examples of, like, you know, Krishna being engaging like that the last time. So do you have any comments or questions on what we spoke today? Yes, Guru. Your voice is bad.
Thank you very much for it. Very nice, Sathanandi. You said that there is no love in the free world. I'm sure it is absolutely true, or there can be exceptions.
That's what the Shastra says.
No, I can give you examples. Mother's love, pure. Radharani's love, purest.
Yes, Radharani's love.
So how can you say that? Thank you. We cannot say anything statement that material love there is a lot of love. If there is a relationship between mother and son or daughter, the material can't exist. So, like, I give you my example. I was only 4 or 5 year old boy, and my mother said, she said exactly same what I was saying. Punyapi Janini, Yakshya Shenu, Praya Maraya, Praya Maraya. If you don't become a devotee of Krishna, you become a dog in that life. That I'm here. I was afraid. I said, I don't want to be a dog. But then I become a human being.
Yep. So I will respond to that. Yes, Radharani's love is the purest. The question is, how can I say that there is no love in the material world? And so Prabhu gave an example of a mother's unconditional love. So he's giving
the quotation.
The quotation?
Punyapi Janini Yakshya Shenu Praya Maraya Praya
Maraya. Translation.
Translation is, we have to cross the material world again and again, unless we become a devotee of Lord Krishna.
I think that is from, if I'm not mistaken, it's from
Adi
Shankaracharya's verse. Punarapi Jananam, Punarapi Maranam, Punarapi Janani, Jatade Sharanam. Iha Samsare, Bahudusvare, Kripaya Apare, Pabhurare.
Exactly.
Ajagovindam, Ajagovindam. I think it's from that.
You become this material again and again. In some form.
Yeah, so it's, the Shastra says there's no love in the material world. It's true, as I was saying before, that material world is based on the principle of lust, it's based on exploitation. And then Krishna says in the Gita that the spirit soul is here to exploit the resources of nature. So you have given the example of mother's unconditional love. Yes, that is the, Prabhupada says, the mother's unconditional love is the closest to love of God. Yes, there is love between a mother and a child. But, you know, generally we have, the mother has a child, or the parents want kids to fulfill a need. Right? Because there is a sense of lacking. There's something missing. So we have a child to fulfill our desires. So it is not pure.
That's all from Krishna.
So that love is not pure. It's not 100% pure. Yes, there is love there. Love means to serve someone without expecting anything in return, right? That's the definition of love. And so pure love can only exist between Krishna, because the service to Krishna has to be unmotivated and should not cease. So the love between mother and son or the parents, there is some motivation there. It is not pure. So I'll give you an example, parents, they send their, in our context, they send us to Australia. Or if you become a brahmachari, or if you join the ashram, what happens? They say, we send you to Australia to make money and to increase the name and fame and send some money back. At least increase the name and fame, right, in the family. Or you've gone there in Melbourne Uni or Oxford University. So there is prestige associated with the upbringing of the children. You know, the parents have certain expectations. So it is not unconditional. There are expectations tied to the kids. And they have to go to a certain Melbourne grammar or a high school to increase the prestige of the parents. And if you give all of that up, if you join the ashram, then there is they get upset. And in some examples, they abandon you, or they treat you unfairly. So the love in the material world is not pure. Yes, there is. That's why it's called lust. To be you know, strictly speaking. So yes, there is service in the material world. We by nature serve others. But that service is mixed with an agenda. Everyone has some agenda. That's why we serve someone. We go to work because there is an agenda. We want to get money so we can enjoy it, have sense gratification. Yes, sir.
What about the quotation for his mother encouraging him to be a devotee? Mm-hmm. What is that?
The quotation of his mother encouraging him to be a devotee?
Yes.
Yeah, so that is true love. Yeah, exactly. Because that is pure desire. And they're engaging you in Krishna service. And that's what Grihastha Ashram is about. That's what parenting is about. And as Bhakti said in the Bhagavatam also that do not become a guru or a parent if you cannot deliver your sibling from the cycle of birth and death. So that's what parenting is about, to make your child a devotee. To try to make them, but ultimately it's their free will. They might not choose to, and you can't do anything about that. You have to respect it. But so yeah, if your mother encouraging you to become a devotee, that is pure love.
Not actually able to do the world.
Yeah. It's a transcendental desire. For me.
Yeah, from so mothers with the pure love. But the children are exploiting mother's love. The children are exploiting mother's love. You don't give back what mother gave us. So in that way, it's not, I mean, it's not pure love in the usual sense. Is it Brahma, right? Saying that?
Yeah, so as I said, I was saying before, in the material world, there's no pure love. But yes, if you don't, if you're not a good child, then you're not reciprocating the mother's love properly. So one should reciprocate with one's mother by respecting, and the best way to reciprocate is to engage in Krishna service and to engage your family also in Krishna service. That's the best way to engage your parents. The It's the best way to restore it. It's to try to lay in the devotee, you know, or to try to bring them closer to Krishna by maybe giving them prasadam, or just being a nice devotee, setting a nice example of a devotee, and by your influence then slowly changing. And that is the best way to restore it. Of course, we also have to take care of our parents, their bodily needs as well. So, as a son or daughter, one has to take care of their needs and look after them. So they can very look after.
I was just thinking of some examples from Prabhupada's life that his father didn't want him to go overseas for get a Western education. So that was like an example of that. Unmotivated desire that his son should become a devotee. And another example that Prabhupada kind of had a cheating propensity when he, I was just thinking of the example when he made a deal for publishing Sagavatira in Japan. And one of his servants was with him, and they Prabhupada just completely tricked them all and made it seem like the price that he was offering was, you know, a fair deal. And it was like the executives walked away from the meeting going, what did we just agree to? You know, like,
yeah, I won't say that she didn't come and speak,
but for Krishna's service.
For Krishna's service he tricked them. You know, if you have to do business you have to be sure. If you're not sure, then you'll be exploited. That's it. That's how the world is. So, Prabhupada was very expert in material dealings, and he knew how to use that
negotiate
for Krishna, for Krishna's favor. Thank you. That's an example. For example, you've already asked. We'll see if anyone has asked. Give everyone a chance.
Like you tell to your parents, they try to inspire them towards Krishna, but they are inspiring you towards materialism. So how are you going to deal with that?
They're inspiring towards materialism, or they're pushing.
Yeah. They say. Let's say I'm here, I'm getting this association, so I'm getting this kind of inspiration, but they've got another kind of inspiration, like, you can imagine it, like, you came to Australia,
there
are a lot of expectations, you know that, so now you are not able to fulfill those kind of expectations, and they are constantly inspiring us to go back to material life, so now how are you going to deal with that?
Yeah, like, the question is, how do you deal with your parents if they are pushing you to become materially successful and you want to be spiritually successful? So like when I came to Australia, I came in touch with Krishna consciousness and I wanted to be a brahmachari, and then I became. And my parents were very upset. I remember that. And they were saying, what are you doing? He's joining ashram. Why do you want to do that? Why can't you just be a grihastha and be a devotee? So, what can you do? It's you have to be fixed in your service to Krishna, because you know what's best for you. They don't know what's best for you. They are misled. They are just going by the stories which other people have told them, and society has told them, you know, how to be, what is success looks like for them. So we have to be convinced of what success is. So for success for a devotee is to be Krishna conscious and to please Krishna and to live in the association of devotees. So if we do that, so we have to be fixed in that, and then we just have to tolerate the parents and be respectful and not compromise our principles. So we have to engage in that way, be respectful, set a good example, and then hopefully they will slowly change.
It's an interesting. There's a conception that spiritual life means material loss.
Mm.
There's this conception. And that was the issue that Maharaj Priyavrata was facing when he wanted to remain a renunciate, and Swami Guru Manu needed him to become a minister, a king. Right? And so Lord Brahma explained to him that Krishna wants to do both. That, you know, a life of renunciation doesn't mean necessarily material failure. And Prabhupada says, Prabhupada mentions
the fact that
taken the spiritual life, or they don't like his mind, or whatever, they don't like Krishna. Very often it's you're envious of Krishna because you know you're giving your life to spiritual pursuits. And you have to live with that, or explain to them, or just be nice to them, such that they'll become more understanding.
No? What's the best way to juggle between both worlds? How do you balance that? How do you balance the spiritual?
When we look at that, we'll be
what's the best way to balance? Because everybody is either.
No, I didn't work for this.
What's the. I just said, when we work with that, we'll make it up. What do you think? How do you do it?
Well, first. I'm just asking because, obviously, you guys are devotees, and I'm not being a devotee, it's my first time coming here.
Yes.
So, just.
So first you need to know what spiritual is and what Krishna consciousness is. So first, even if you don't know that, how can we even begin to balance? So that's the first step. To understand Krishna and to understand the spiritual lifestyle and to start practicing it. And when we start practicing it, gradually we will get the intelligence, and by associating with other devotees who have successfully done it, we will learn the practical ways how to, strike a balance.
Sadhana. You know what sadhana means? One of the first things that struck me when I met the ladies on the street selling books was they had a practice. Sadhana basically means practice. And so they had activities that you could add to your life that provide spiritual input, spiritual practice knowledge. Was your family from India?
Yeah.
Do you know what puja is?
Yeah, of course.
Look, so puja, japa, chanting, right? Studying the scripture.
So they're like, you've got to basically follow a couple of steps to attain the spiritual side ends of Buddha,
Things to do that.
What was it, A, B, C, B or something like that? Association? And then association books, chanting, something to do with
diet.
So association books.
Books,
chanting, and
diet. Prabhu summed it up, so you have to engage in sadhana. So sadhana means practice. We have to practice being in the
association.
We have to practice being in the association with devotees, and then humbly listening. So listening to the shastra, listening to Bhagavad Katha, and also reading it. And then also to have prasadam. Because we have to eat. So to what we eat, we have to offer it. In fact, make our life as an offering to God. Whatever we are doing, we do it for Krishna. So it's a practice, and practice takes time. It doesn't happen in one day. So sadhana means we have to do it repeatedly. So if you get good at something, then you do it repeatedly. So as we do it repeatedly, that's why sadhana means to do these activities every day. Then
you'll start seeing the class.
Then we'll automatically see, we'll begin to prioritize what's important for us. Because at this point, it's a prioritization problem. We cannot prioritize what is in our best interest. We are engaged in other activities. And we give them a higher priority than our Krishna conscious development. But as Prabhu was saying, if we engage, if we have good sadhana, then we will automatically prioritize these activities. And that doesn't mean we have to give up working. Then in fact, the working and business and all those affairs are to support our spiritual practice. They become pillars to support us. Because you have to pay your bills, you have to live, you have a mortgage, maybe, you have a family.
There are physical necessities as well. Yeah. I'm struggling with the spiritual side.
One of the most important things is getting up early in the morning, because most of us have got a full day, right? From 7 o'clock in the morning till 7 o'clock at night at least, and some people till 10 o'clock at night. But they're working, and working hard. So one of the most important elements of bhakti practice is getting up earlier so that we can put in an hour or two of activities that nourish our spirituality, our spiritual identity. Because at the moment we're working, you know, like asses. Or we're working hard. And so it's hard to look at how we fit in anything to our life. So getting up early, you know, 3-4 o'clock in the morning for some people. 2 or 3 hours that you can dedicate just to chanting, to studying, to puja, then that nourishes your spiritual identity. And so that's what sankara means, that's another point of that. And so, you know, what time do you go to work in the morning?
If you start at 8.
Right, when do you finish?
4:30.
Right. What time do you start your morning program?
5:30.
Yeah. And what do you do?
Chant.
Yeah, so that's the first thing that most of us is at. Is get up an hour earlier or a couple of hours earlier and just sit down and chant. And that's the best time to do it anyway because there's no distraction. As soon as the sun comes up, then your mind's just full of, go do this, go do that. Right? So that's why in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna recommends that one should rise early to perform a spiritual practice. And you know, that's the best time for the day to do it. So that's where you kind of start.
Yeah, and if the sadhana is good, then we will be able to balance and have the intelligence to know how to balance. Otherwise, the material conditions, they consume us. Thank you. All right, it's 9 o'clock. No further questions, we'll end here. Natasha Bhagavatam ki jai.